You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
It's the first time that Apple have actually decided to tell people about something that they're developing.
High-speed broadband. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
The three main spamming countries are the United States, China, and South Korea.
And I've got some residual powers.
Sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
Senator Clinton, the voice of reason.
There's a couple of systems on a gantry that's actually based on a military missile tracking system.
You put the date on ePray, and you get a whole service just on it.
How does it go?
IE7, you were having trouble installing it because you had a genuine copy of Windows that wouldn't validate properly. What did you have to do to get past that?
Built a new machine.
But how hard can it be?
No, it's not hard at all.
At the end of the day, the photography is all about the person's eye and what they see.
If you find something that's inappropriate about your child, you need to do something about it because it will not go away.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Tech Talk Radio. I'm your host, Andrew McComb. One thing in this world is for sure, life and death. And this week in Australia, we're about to see the passing of CDMA. CDMA was the phoenix that rose from the ashes of the old AMPS mobile phone network in 1999. AMPS was an acronym for Advanced Mobile Phone System and was the first generation of mobile communications. At the time of CDMA's launch, second generation mobile devices, as we know it, digital cellular mobile phones, were in their prime, and CDMA promised a solution to a problem that the then GSM network faced, and that was a distance limitation where the handsets could be no further than a maximum distance of about 40 kilometres from the base station. Second generation users found it frustrating that even if their phone had signal, if they were beyond the maximum distance from the base station, they couldn't use their phone. So in September 1999, in rode CDMA, a knight in shining armour aimed at rural customers who, up until now, had felt left out of the digital mobile phone revolution because of the distance limitation. I'm sure you remember the television commercial where massive white sheets were dragged across hills and valleys, signifying the fantastic coverage of CDMA. Anyway, in just a few days' time, those white sheets have to be folded up to make way for the continuing rollout of Telstra's next-generation mobile technology. 8.5 years was CDMA's life, not bad in this day and age, but nonetheless, she'll be sadly missed by some. Her epitaph will read, "So long, old friend, cut down in your prime, but such is the price of progress, 1999 to 2008.
This week on Tech Talk Radio,
we take a look at the mobile phone history in Australia. Adam Turner looks at the problems of kids and computer games. We continue Lydia's report on the RSA conference in San Francisco. Telstra becomes a teacher for the older Australians. Rent videos on your iPod. And a new spam outbreak says it's seen you naked. First up, here's the latest happenings from the Tech Talk news desk with Dr. Ron.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, recession? What recession? Google posts a $1.3 billion profit for the first quarter of 2008. Australian Federal Police raid homes in pirate satellite TV syndicate. There's money to be made from YouTube's new partner program. A survey warns employers against blocking access to social networking sites. And the Tasmanian Health Department is sued by a voice and data company for not paying its bills. Welcome to Tech Talk News. Internet search juggernaut Google has defied analysts' expectations, posting a $1.31 billion profit for the first quarter of 2008. First quarter revenue totaled $5.19 billion, up 42% from the same time last year. And for the first time in its 9.5-year history, more than half of Google's revenue came from outside the United States. Google's chief executive, Eric Schmidt, told analysts last week that it's clear we are well positioned for 2008 and beyond, regardless of the business environment we are surrounded by. Investors had serious doubts about Google's short-term prospects before Thursday's announcement, as analysts believed that Google's advertising links, which make money for Google, weren't attracting as much consumer interest as they had in the past. But Google said the slowdown in ad clicking largely reflected deliberate policy changes in which the number of advertisements had been reduced while sponsors paid more for each ad link, ultimately generating more revenue from fewer clicks. Mr. Schmidt told the Los Angeles Times that Google's ongoing innovation in search, ads, and apps helped drive healthy growth globally across product lines, yielding another strong quarter for Google. Australian Federal Police last week seized hundreds of fake pay TV SIM cards after 10 properties were raided in Victoria, Queensland, and New South Wales. Police also seized $169,000 and several computers. Two men were arrested in Victoria for offences under the Commonwealth Copyright Act after the six-month investigation into a syndicate producing fake subscription TV or gamma cards. The TV smart cards are used in digital set-top boxes and decrypt satellite television signals. The head of the Australian Subscription Television and Radio Association, Deborah Richards, told The Age Tech last week that piracy endangered employment and investment in paid television. Ms. Richards said the association was really pleased in terms of what's happened and that it sends a great message to the market that there are serious consequences to the activity. The chief executive of Foxtel, Kim Williams, said the raids send a message about piracy and that the actions by the AFP send a clear message to the Australian public that piracy of STV is a serious crime, it is theft and will be treated accordingly. A Mount Waverley man was charged with making and selling unauthorised decoders and dealing with the proceeds of crime, and was bailed to appear in the Melbourne Magistrates Court on the 9th of July. Budding film stars that upload videos to YouTube are now set to make real money with the introduction of the YouTube Partner Program. The scheme provides money to YouTube content creators in exchange for displaying banner ads on videos, and the program was launched in Australia last week. The program has been operating in the United States and the United Kingdom for some time, with some participants earning thousands of dollars per month. YouTube said that the program is open to all sorts of content creators with popular, widely viewed videos. To become a YouTube partner, users need to create original videos suitable for online streaming. They need to own copyrights and distribution rights for all audio and video that's uploaded, and partners need to upload videos regularly that are viewed by thousands of YouTube users. A new study by Galaxy Research has shown that employers who block internet access to social networking sites could risk alienating employees and job seekers. Half of those surveyed said they would prefer to work for an employer that allowed them to socialise on Facebook and MySpace over one that didn't. And in addition to the personal value of social networking, 75% of respondents said they believed it brought benefits to the company as well. Mr. Nick Abrahams, head of the Technology, Media and Telecommunications Law Practice at Deakins, said that future studies were expected to show IT companies are now more tolerant of Web 2.0 applications. Mr. Abrahams said that short of blocking or restricting access to Web 2.0 applications in the workplace, organisations should at the very least implement employee policies for use at work. And in what's being described as a David and Goliath battle, a small telecommunications company in Hobart, Away Voice and Data, has enlisted the services of a debt collector to recover an outstanding payment from the Tasmanian Health Department. The account for $720, which is allegedly months overdue, is for work done at the end of 2007. The company's managing director, Alan Warren, has written to the health minister and put the department on his list of poor payers. Mr. Warren said that while the amount wasn't a great deal to the government, to a small business like his, it's one person's wage for a week. And said Mr. Warren, when it all comes down to it, why should small business be financing the government? I'm Dr. Rhyme, and that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
The latest developments in the Microsoft Yahoo affair have advertising executives contemplating a drastically different landscape in the online world.
What's the collective noun of doctors?
A dosage.
We're about 2 weeks away from shutdown of the CDMA mobile phone network.
When customers do start ramping up their usage, they can't cope and things start to slow down.
The other option too is personalisation.
For anyone in marketing or fundraising or any of those sorts of areas, that's exactly what they want.
You can't say that your Mac is entirely secure, but the likelihood of you getting hit is obviously totally different.
There are a few items that are exempt from this new system.
Well, they have special policies for those items anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. So
people can forward to a friend.
Also, email marketing gives you the ability to send a little bit of contact to people who you would never feel appropriate to call.
See, I should get out more often.
Yeah, good on him.
Pearl of wisdom.
Oh, that really needs to be done, yeah? Go on.
We're sorry to see you go.
That's right.
Was it something we said?
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And And here we are back again. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show that is Tech Talk Radio. I'm the host, Andrew McComb, and sitting in front of me this evening in holiday mode or something. He's looking a bit scruffy tonight. Dr. Ron, good evening to you. Obviously working hard again.
Thank you,
burning
Andrew.
The midnight candle again or something.
Yeah, I do get a bit scruffy sometimes, don't I?
I know. I think we all do in this technological world of ours. We spend too many hours under the bench for all the wrong reasons because there's, you know, cables needing to be plugged in or something course of time.
Sometimes you work long hours through the night and... Yeah, you become sort of stuck to the office there, don't you?
We are indeed. Guess who I spoke to during the course of the week?
Who'd you speak
Mark
to?
Mark Diggins.
How is Mark?
Mark's good. He's been 3 months missing in action here in Australia. He's currently in Boston. And he's all sorts of things have happened over there for him at the moment. And I did speak to him on the phone saying, righto, buddy, you've been there for 3 months now. Let's talk on the radio.
Yeah, we need a report.
We do. So anyway, that will be coming very shortly. One of our regulars who's now over in the States. So we've got two regulars in the States now.
Yeah, we do.
Very international. What are we doing? Radio show.
We're going to be hearing from Lyd a bit later as well.
We are indeed. And speaking of Lyd, a cheerio at the top of the show. Happy birthday to Lyd's partner, Martin, her husband.
Oh, happy birthday, Martin.
Happy birthday to him because, yes, she was saying, you sent me all this stuff and I've got to do this birthday. So Martin's over there. He's another year older, a little bit more wrinkly like the rest of us. So, you know, happy birthday, Martin, and from all the kids and all that sort of stuff. So, yes. What else has happened this week, Dr. Ron?
We have a lot of feedback, a lot of Tech Talk radio feedback.
Should we get into it?
Yeah, we should. If you want to send us a message, if you've got some criticism or some story or something that you'd like us to talk about, feedback@techtalkradio.com.au.
Hello, GD. I'm watching and listening now.
That will find us. We've got a message from Andy B. G'day, Andy.
Hello, Andy.
Back in March, my credit card expired. I was issued a new one with the same number but different expiry date. Around the same time, I got a heap of emails from various places for web hosting and so on.
I'm hanging out for that.
That my card is about to expire and I should log in and provide a new card number with a valid expiry date.
It's a really good way of getting rid of ISPs if you don't if you want to change it, you don't want to go through the rigmarole because some of them make you jump hoops. But go on, did Andy say?
Well, Andy says, quite annoyingly, some places didn't bother to notify him. He appreciates that it's his problem to keep his details up to date, but some places simply discontinued service without so much as a warning email. Blizzard was one such offender. Now, Blizzard is the World of Warcraft creator.
Yes.
So his account on World of Warcraft was suspended until he provided a valid credit card. Thankfully, his account was reactivated and he's now back playing his level 70 Blood Elf Paladin. Good work, Andy.
Fantastic. I must admit, you know the PowerWeb disaster we had last week when they deleted us for no reason?
Yes.
They did actually send me a reminder for my credit card the other day saying
time
to pay. I said, because we haven't had any notification back from your IT guy who decided to disconnect us for no apparent reason, I don't know whether I should give you my credit card details.
And did that get a response?
Bittersweet. No, not yet. I'll post it up on the webpage. You know there's a webpage on the Tech Talk Radio site about that.
That's funny because you'd think if you started threatening the accounts people, that might have a different effect to trying to negotiate with stubborn technical people.
Yes.
Marley says, guys, I like to Telstra bash as much as anyone, but I think it's getting a little too much. Every time their name is mentioned, the same old one-liners roll out.
Do we ever got a repertoire of one-liners, have we?
Marley thinks we do.
Sorry, Marley.
At the end of the day, they are the most expensive, etc. carrier, but they do have the best network out there.
Yes, you won't get an argument.
I tried Three and most of the other carriers, and they do pale in comparison. Three was woeful. Yes, I do know they use Telstra 3G and some of the GSM network. I travel all around Australia's rural and remote regions and around the world. I have a GSM BlackBerry, NextG phone and a NextG data card, and they do work nearly everywhere I need them. By the way, love the show. Great to have a show with Australian content, etc. Thanks, Marley. Glad you enjoy the show. Thank you for the criticism.
An email. Yes, thank you. Bouquets and all that sort of stuff. Just send it to us.
Well, Telstra does a good job. We try to...
Well, we had Telstra in the other day. We were talking about the Telstra Foundation. They're doing a fantastic job there.
We had them in as a guest on the show.
Absolutely. Mm. The grants, they got $2 million from memory. Thereabouts, they're giving out to organisations to help protect, keep our young people safe online, which I think is a wonderful thing to do.
It was Georgia Simmons from the Telstra Foundation we had off the top of my head. So we try to be balanced, but...
Yes.
So,
we try.
Sometimes they have a run of bad press in a week and it's difficult.
Darren's listening to us on the stream, I'm guessing, just straight in, not more than 2 minutes ago. Hi, guys. Are you familiar with Ustream or Live Yahoo? I'd love to see you guys in action. Have you got to be kidding? It's hard enough to streaming audio, let alone video.
It took us a few years to get the audio sussed out, didn't it?
So, Darren and Manila, thank you for sending that. One day we might just sneak it on our listeners. We'll do a test because we've done the odd
what do you call it? Webcam thing here in the studio from time to time. There's probably an image there still from about 3 months ago. But we will endeavour to do that one day shortly, do a bit of a live streaming. And
people like myself have to get to the studio in more time than just 3 minutes before going live, don't we? So, so we can actually set all this stuff up beforehand.
Oh, absolutely. Mm. That'd be good. Yes.
Hey, did you get one of these?
He says
holding this up
a...
to the microphone. It's a letter that says Telstra.
Oh, careful. Some of our listeners will get stroppy.
Your new look bill will contribute towards saving over 30,000 trees a year. They're going to change their billing.
Hey, my billing saves me plenty. I get an email. I don't have a paper bill anymore from
Telstra. How long have you done electronic billing?
With Telstra?
Mm.
At a guess, maybe 2 or 3 years. It seems that long anyway.
I tried it 2 or 3 years ago, and it was a disaster.
Oh, yeah?
Absolute disaster. You couldn't log on. You couldn't see your services. When you finally did get to log on, it had my name and my address there, but phone numbers that weren't even mine.
They're not bad at them. Yeah, well, you have your surname, Smith. There's plenty of them in the phone book.
It's understandable.
Exactly right. Which Smith have we got here? There's a Dr. Smith. There's probably thousands of them out there.
Dr. Smith. There's a Dr. Smith, a Dr. Dr. Ron Smith. Well,
In all due respects, their Telstra billing system is working very well at the moment.
Online, is it?
Yep.
Well, this says I can go online for free. If I want paper bills to continue to be sent, they will, but I will no longer have itemised calls. There'll just be a summary. So instead of having a 20-page bill, just be one page.
Oh, good on you, Telstra. Well done. You should try doing the same with the banks. The bank that I do a lot of commerce with is the Commonwealth Bank. They've now put all their bills as PDF files online, which is really handy if you lose your bill.
Ah, yeah.
It gets lost in the mail or something like that. You just download the PDF and print off another one. Really good come reconciliation time, let me tell you.
A lot of internet service providers do that for their billing. You can go to your log in as your member account number, and you can see a history of your invoices there as PDF files.
Mm.
Well, my ISP
does. Good
idea. Yeah.
I think everyone should do that if you can. PDFs and emails are really good. I know for business you have to print them out and keep them in the folder for 7 years, but that's the tax office. Maybe they'll let you put them on a CD or something like that down the track. Anyway. All right, feedback at techtalkradio.com.au. That is where you can send us an email. You can also text us 0430-582-077. From wherever you might happen to be in this great big country of ours, recommend the email for those living a bit further afield like Darren in Manila. So, all right. Now, the big news this week, Telstra is going to be turning off its CDMA network because they said, yes, it's okay to do that. Now, CDMA has been around, as I alluded to in the opening of the program.
About 10 years, something like that?
About eight.
Eight, is it?
1999 to 2008.
Mm.
So about 8.5 years, I think it is. But anyway, she was a fairly interesting technology when it was rolled out. Still is. We're actually using wideband CDMA in our next G coverage. So it sort of still lives on.
The technology lives on.
To a certain degree. But, you know, when I was preparing this report and thinking about where we've been and where we've come from, the technology that we've been using for mobile phones dates back a fair way, back to the 80s, really, when we had bricks and before that.
Phones.
The old 007 sort of things.
Oh, that's going back a few years.
Do you remember your first brick? Did you have a brick?
I do. I did have a brick, yes. It was a telecom brick.
Was it?
Mm.
And it worked okay?
Yeah, it worked very well. It was
an analog. Call dropouts?
Yeah. Yeah, well, everyone's always had call dropouts, and everyone always will, I think. It's one of those facts of life.
Mm. So if you're living in the countryside now and you haven't, you're still using your CDMA handset after the 28th of this month, it will no longer work. You just won't get service. So I guess you're being forced to move to the new network out of necessity, if nothing else. But it's not a bad network. Once they do, because the old network and the new network's on the same frequency, and we only have a finite number of radio channels in that bandwidth. As soon as they turn off CDMA, we'll have a lot more space for the next G stuff. So we'll get twice the capacity, theoretically.
That's what we're hoping. We're hoping to see a sudden market improvement.
I still never got my call from the network engineers.
They never rang back?
No, but keep going.
We should see a very definite improvement on the next G network because all of the equipment and all of the tower space and the radio site space will all be freed up so that the next G equipment can take its place.
Jeff Booth works for Telstra. This is what he had to say.
On the 29th of April, if customers have a CDMA handset, it will not work. We will certainly keep the numbers associated with these old CDMA handsets available for those customers for 28 days post the close, and customers will be able to get those numbers on new NextG handsets. Customers now have access to a world-leading 21st century network. Customers can look forward to a bigger and faster mobile and wireless broadband network in regional Australia. One network, city to country. One network which roams across more than 100 countries in the world. And so I think it's great news for regional Australians. We've been through a rigorous process leading up to the closure. And I think that this now confirms the government's confidence that we do have a network which is equal to or better than the CDMA network in regional Australia.
And there you go. You can keep your old number for up to a month if you've been slack and not done your upgrade or just not renewing or anything like that. So that was just Jeff Booth from Telstra saying that they're all systems go for the big cutover this coming weekend, I think, isn't it? Yeah, well, not far off anyway.
I never owned a CDMA phone.
Didn't you?
No, did you ever have a CDMA phone?
No, I never had the pleasure. They used to not have SIMs in them, if I recall. They were SIMless,
which is
the subscriber identity module, that little thing that you get and you stick in the back of your phone.
The phone number was actually coded into the handset.
Really? What happened if you lost your handset?
If you lost your handset,
where's Mark,
well,
they could
disable it in the network and they could assign the number to a new handset. Mm-hmm. But it was, yeah, annoying.
Yes.
When they launched CDMA, it was supposed to be it was targeted at rural Australia, wasn't it?
It was, because it filled the gap that was
left by the analog closure.
Yeah, because analog worked, you know, it was
everywhere, distance
independent. It could go wherever it wanted to go. Mm. And then this digital fandangling thing came along and they couldn't go too far.
So for a long time they had GSM.
This filled the gap.
GSM for metro and CDMA for country.
Let's have a bit of a reminisce, shall we?
Oh, good.
Get out the Wayback Machine and have this is a reminder of mobile technology throughout Australia's history from the early 80s.
Oh, this will be good.
In August 1981, Telecom Australia launched the first public automated mobile phone system in Melbourne, followed by a Sydney launch in November. Known as PAMPS, which is abbreviated to MTS or just 007 after the telephone number prefix, this service was fully automatic but not cellular. In mobile phone generation terms, it was a 0G service. This was a car phone system only, and it involved a radio transmitter attached to the boot of each subscriber's car and a handset with a large cradle inside the car. A system would cost you around about $5,000 to buy and installed with a $350 connection fee and an annual access fee of $800. In 1987, Telecom Australia launched Australia's first cellular network based on the US AMPS, which stood for Advanced Mobile Phone System, an analog or first generation standard. Handheld mobile phones, otherwise known as bricks, were sold for around $4,500 each. This network launched in Sydney in February and in Melbourne in May was extended over time into other capitals and major cities and then country areas not long after. In June 1989, the 100,000th AMPS service was connected. In January 1992, Optus was licensed as a carrier and began to resell the AMPS service in June. By October, the 500,000th AMPS connection was made. In December 92, Vodafone was also licensed as a carrier and began building its own network. In 1993, Telecom Australia changed their name to Telstra and launched a new second-generation digital mobile phone network, GSM, on the 27th of April. The company continued operating its AMPS analog network, and at this time there are around about 635,000 analog mobile phones in Australia. Less than 4% of the population had one. Also in 1993, Optus launched its digital mobile network in May, and Vodafone followed in October. In March 1994, it was reported that the number of AMPS connections had reached 1 million. By July 1995, it was reported that there were 300,000 subscribers on the three digital GSM networks, while there were 2 million AMPS subscribers. In June 1996, it was reported that the 1 millionth digital subscriber had been connected and there were 2.6 million AMPS network subscribers in Australia. In 1998, Telstra MobileNet customers, both AMPS and the digital network, exceeded 3 million for the first time. Telstra announced plans to build a new network to replace the AMPS network, which was to be phased out due to government regulation. The new network was to be based on CDMA, Code Division Multiple Access technology. In September 1999, Telstra launched the CDMA network, and by the end of December, the AMPS networks were largely closed down.
In March, just after the turn of the century, Hutchison launched another CDMA network in Sydney and Melbourne, and in June, OneTel launched a GSM 1800 network using a competing second-generation technology. By September that year, the AMPS network was fully closed in Australia, spelling the final end of the brick. In February 2001, it was reported that the number of mobile phones, not subscribers in Australia, exceeded the number of landlines, or over 10.7 million. In June, OneTel's GSM 1800 network was closed, and shortly after, Telstra commercially launched a GPRS data system across its GSM network, supporting basic email and internet access for the first time on mobile phones. In 2003, it was reported that at the start of the year, there were just over 6.3 million subscribers on the Telstra GSM network alone, and around 700,000 subscribers on their CDMA network. Australia's first third-generation network was launched in April, with the NEC E606 mobile phone the first released in Australia to support video calls and broadband speed internet access. In 2005, Australian mobile phone users reached 9 million, or just under half the population, with 8 million mobile phone handsets sold through the year. And in 2006, Hutchison reported in June that they had connected the 1 millionth Australian third-generation mobile phone subscriber. This has been a very brief history of mobile telephones in Australia on Tech Talk Radio.
Yeah, there you go. Very brief it was indeed, but nonetheless, did you remember some of those landmarks throughout the course of that?
I did. It was a good walk down memory lane, that one.
Remember OneTel?
Yeah, a lot of people remember OneTel for all the wrong reasons.
You didn't get stung by them. I was a customer with them at one stage.
Were
you? Back then, I remember I've got a couple of the old little green furry bills to prove it too.
Yes, that's right. So, the little cartoon man with his beard.
That's them,
that
yeah.
Surfy looking guy.
Yeah.
Mm. GPRS email. I used to work for a company that used to set up portals for
really?
GPRS, for WAP.
Yeah. Okay. It's pretty amazing where we've come these days, haven't we, with the technology. And it's only going to get sort of amazingly better either. Mobile search being critical to all this sort of websites and things like that, finding things online. Now, I was really, really lucky to speak to a Rico Malvar, who is the Managing Director of Research. That's his title, Managing Director of Research from Microsoft. And he's very passionate about mobile communications and where it's going to go in the next little bit. But just to, as a bit of a preface to this, mobile search will become a global business worth about $5 billion by 2013. Now, I was talking to Rico about what's potentially going to happen down the track.
Yep.
And we do have I spoke to him for about an hour on the phone the other day. Absolutely fantastic gentleman to speak to. And we're going to be replaying that in Tech Talk Radio in the next few weeks.
Terrific.
But anyway, by 2013, this is going to be worth about $5 billion. You add to your mobile device the GPS location devices and all those sort of things, and your handset is really going to become a part of your day-to-day life, not only for contacts and email and stuff like that, but for giving you advice and things like Rico was saying that as you walk down the street, you can sort of open your phone up in front of a restaurant and you can say, tell me a review of this. You don't have to key in where the restaurant is or where you are.
Knows where you're standing.
And you can dig down into it. And that's the sort of applications that are going to come. And this is where mobile search is going to become fairly important in the way we're going to be doing things as well. The growth of consumer options to search on mobile devices by SMS, via branded or web or white label search providers has created opportunities for advertisers to reach consumers through sponsored search opportunities. Because like with everything else, you get the ability to advertise with it and all that sort of stuff.
Yep.
The analyst firm estimates that mobile search advertising growth will be driven by this escalating array of options as total search-related mobile advertisements expands from currently at around $813 million to around about $5 billion by 2013. So this is just the start of it where we are at the moment. What I thought I'd do is I'll just play a little excerpt from Rico's interview, which I had last week, just in relation to what we're talking about with mobile search.
Very good.
One thing that we just kind of released as a beta from Live Search with a lot of help here from research is searching in your mobile phone with voice. Because if you're at a computer and you want to search, you can open a search page, there's a little window, and you can type the words you want. But if you're on the street with your mobile, typing, even if your mobile has the keys, they're very small and it's easy to mistype. But it actually has a nice screen. So it's better to do a multimodal thing where you speak the words of the search you're looking for. I don't know, restaurant, ABC, or whatever you're looking for. And then you get the results in the screen. And you can click on those results. And from there on, you can follow up a more more traditional navigation. But that combination of using voice and using keys at the same time can help the user quite a bit.
So the keyboard interface is not long for the world. We're going to start using our voice, and we're going to talk to our mobile devices as we walk down the streets.
Well, that's good. The proof of the pudding will be in the accuracy, I suppose, of the speech recognition, and also not just the accuracy of it understanding what you've said, but its interpretation of what you want.
I did speak to Rico about the traumas and dilemmas that we've had with voice recognition over the course of time, and he seemed to think that we were overcoming a lot of those problems.
Oh, good.
So
good.
Watch this space, or listen to this space, because in the next few weeks I will be running that that interview at depth with Rico, who is the managing director of research from Microsoft.
I look forward to hearing that.
In the heart of the United States, Redmond, where it all happens anyway.
Sounds like you had a great chin wag there for some time.
It was absolutely terrific. Mm. Whilst we're on the subject of mobile communications devices, Vodafone cuts its international data roaming charges. This is a sign of the time. We're seeing a lot of these new... Well, data's just so cheap, and voice really gets converted to data anyway nowadays before it gets shipped off on our mobile devices. But Vodafone launched two international data roaming plans that it says will dramatically reduce the price of mobile internet access for Australians traveling to over 38 countries. So that feedback you had before too, maybe there's an option to try Vodafone. Because that's always been the real, you know, thorn in the side of mobile broadband, isn't it?
Yep.
Roaming.
Yep.
It's like, bend over.
Oh. And we'll kick you up the backside.
Absolutely.
Because that's exactly right. It has always been very expensive. And what we're going to be seeing, hopefully, is the cost of data just approaching zero, just going down, 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 down. Because at the end of the day, we don't want to be paying for data. We want to be paying for value-added services where they're relevant to us and useful to us. And I think that's the model that Vodafone are looking at.
I think video and things like that will all come into its own. You know, there's things out there that haven't even been thought of yet, which people will want to actually look at, see and touch and feel and all that sort of stuff. So that's, as you say, value-adding will be important.
We can imagine video-based value-added services with your location-based services.
Well, that's what it's all about, isn't it?
There's stuff there that people haven't even imagined yet that we'll be able to do with this technology, which is great. The only thing that I would be a little bit wary of, and I think Adam Turner mentioned this to me a few weeks ago when we were talking about similar technology, location-based spam. That's one thing that would be unbearable. If you walk past a restaurant and your mobile phone beeped and said, hey, you were in here a few weeks ago.
What's wrong with that?
Try the veal.
Yeah,
because I don't want to get bombarded with spam on a mobile phone. That's the last bastion of my privacy, and it's something which is in...
How would they do that?
That I have control over, and I don't want to have my mobile phone sent into my email inbox. That would be disastrous.
They wouldn't know your phone number, would they, surely, as you walked past?
I don't know. It depends on how this technology is implemented. So.
Well, it's yet to be seen. But yes, that would be fairly detrimental, I would have thought. All right, and briefly before we take a break, older Australians are switching to technology, thanks to Telstra. Thousands of older Australians are learning more about the internet and mobile phones thanks to the Telstra Connected Seniors program. This is a good initiative on behalf of the company.
Okay.
Over the past 8 months, more than 110 community organisations have already shared over $750,000 to help run education programs that teach those aged 60 and over how to better use communications technology.
Oh, good.
What a great idea. Mm. David Moffat, who's Telstra's head of consumer marketing and channels, said that they were thrilled with the number of organisations that have taken the opportunity to learn how the internet works from mobile phones.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. I think everyone's starting to embrace the new technology, the new ways of doing things, whether up until now you've sort of had your head in the sand, didn't want to know about it. It's time to embrace it. There's organisations out there helping you get on board. And once you do get on board, there's all sorts of fantastic things you can do, because traditionally seniors do tend to have a bit of extra spare time on their hands. And let me tell you, the internet can fix that. Genealogy, a wonderful, wonderful pastime that I have.
Genealogy, yes.
Tracing back your ancestral roots and things like that. I can speak personally here. My family are big into that. And as a result, I have certain members of my family that eat, live and breathe on the internet looking for all sorts of, you know, images of tombstones and shipping records and things like that. A lot of fun. But there's just a small example of how you can spend your time online.
And also empowering people with mobile devices is what it's all about. As well, the sooner that we get over the concept of having a mobile telephone and embrace the concept of having a handheld communications device, the better,
I think. Let's ponder that. We'll be back with more in a moment.
listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Andrew McColman, Dr. Ron on the panel this evening. We're going to talk about video games.
Last of
like
the party harders. Where's everybody else?
I don't know. Well, Mark's overseas. Yes. Graham's, yes. And Adam, we're about to hear from Adam, actually.
Oh, good. Oh, that's all right.
That'd be good. I did try and put a call into JD this evening. Hello, JD, if you're out there.
Hi, JD.
Whatever he's up to and all that sort of stuff. But kids and video games.
Yes.
Is it a
big kids or?
No.
Real kids.
Well, I guess it applies to under 18 kids, yep. I guess, those who are living at home and things like that. And we have the dilemma of, video content. Some of these games, which, you know, we've all seen the bang, bang, shoot 'em up type sort of things, where we'll probably play them ourselves as a kid. But what happens when the kids aren't quite ready for that sort of, you know, thing that we see on the screen? Is it becoming a problem, do you think?
I don't know if it's becoming a problem. I don't know if it is a problem. I don't have children. I don't have a lot of experience with games and kids.
Yeah. I just sort of think that potentially exposing younger kids to excessive violence and video games in particular, the Office of Film Literature and Classification have chosen not to categorize, purely on the basis that, you know, it's a bit rough, you know, not to be seen in this country. But I think in a lot of respects, that's just a bit like a red rag to a bull, isn't it? They all those sort of, you know, people that want it, just go and get it. Take Underbelly, for example. Yes. A program in Australia, in Melbourne, about Melbourne's underworld. And, I think everyone's seen it in Melbourne, yet you weren't allowed to watch it. They wouldn't let it run on television.
I'm always surprised by classifications in the United States, and I don't think I'm alone here. We find it very, very odd, with respect to all of our United States listeners, that the censors over there very, very heavily censor what we would consider to be mild blasphemy, but they let a lot of very, very violent content go through.
Yeah, well, I guess you're right. They're a different society to what we are. They're fairly conservative compared to what we are, but yet, it swings both
ways. A lot of
ways.
People would say, you know, if I exclaim, you know, see something, I go, God, you know, that's just it's like a mild sort of, you know.
Oh, yes.
Blaspheme, isn't it? But that would be a lot of situations in America where that would be censored.
Well,
Would be bleeped out or whatever, but they'll let a lot of very, very violent, potentially
they're
a lot more damaging
extremes of what they do and don't.
Well, it's different, isn't it? Different standards, perhaps, or different, not necessarily wrong standards, but different to what we're used to here.
Speaking from a television production point of view, I know that when we make television programs these days, we tend to make them for an international consumption as well as locally.
Mm.
And when you're shipping content to, say, for example, a Middle Eastern country where, you know, seeing a woman without a veil, I'm not sure the technical term that goes over their face, and you know, they're partly clad, we can't show that. So it has to be either removed or edited out of the content.
Is that right? And that's because the film and literature classification people over there have that as a rule or a regulation.
Exactly. So we're all different.
We're all
really,
different
what it all
standards,
comes down.
Aren't there, all over the world?
Certain things are tolerated in our society visually and audibly than aren't in other societies. Yeah. And I guess that's what we're all about, really. Anyway.
But we don't have classifications here with video games, do we?
We do. Yes, we do.
Oh, we do?
Oh, small. Yes, we do. But we don't have an R classification.
Well, that's what I'm thinking of. We haven't got an R classification.
There's talk about that, and there's probably people out there that know more about it than I do. But everything goes up to M15+ at the moment, and anything beyond that, where I think they have really bad violence and like sex and things like that, does not get a classification, so therefore can't be sold legally in Australia, and it's probably big on the download charts.
Does Adam have a view?
Adam certainly does have a view, and let's go and see what's on the couch as we speak.
Adam Turner's View from the Couch on Tech Talk Radio.
My 4-year-old son has discovered computer games, and there's no turning back. He's been playing the puzzles on the ABC Kids and Wiggles websites for a few years. But now he's progressed to the more advanced games on Nickelodeon's Nick Jr. website. He loves Dora the Explorer and Diego games, which would be because they're the only shows on commercial television that he and his little sister are allowed to watch. It's interesting that, given a choice, he'd much rather play the games than watch the shows. He's taken to the Dora platform games quickly, and you can see his problem-solving skills developing, along with his hand-eye coordination. I'd say he's almost ready for Mario Brothers, and that's where the problems start. I'm trying to make sure he strikes a better balance between indoor and outdoor activities than I did as a kid, something which a games console certainly won't help with. I have an old PlayStation 1 lying around, but I think I'm going to hold off as long as possible. There will come a day when he demands his own game console and starts playing games at other kids' houses, but for now, I think that time will be better spent off running around in the sunshine. Of course, that requires more of an effort from me, as the easy solution is just to let him sit in front of a screen all day. As he gets older, the problem is not going to be just striking a balance between computer games and the real world, but monitoring which games he plays. The two big games in the news at the moment are The Sims and Grand Theft Auto. The Sims has just cracked 100 million sales since its launch in 2000. Meanwhile, Grand Theft Auto is sitting on 65 million copies sold as we await the release of GTA 4, a decade after the first installment was released. These two titles sit at the opposite ends of the gaming spectrum. The Sims was a precursor to Second Life and revolves around building virtual societies, while Grand Theft Auto is considered by some to reflect the decay of First Life society. One's about building relationships, one's about stealing cars and bashing hookers. Once he's a teenager, it's foolish to think I'll be able to completely stop my son from playing games like Grand Theft Auto. It's my job as a parent to ensure that by the time he gets to that age, he understands the concepts of sex and violence and is capable of making informed decisions about the types of games he plays. For the moment, that means restricting the games that he plays and television he watches until he's old enough to understand it in context. Of course, by the time he's a teenager, most games will be internet-enabled, which opens up a whole new issue of online stranger danger. It will be interesting to see what happens to computer games over the next decade. Does the fact that more people prefer to play The Sims than Grand Theft Auto mean the Puritans are winning the battle for the hearts and minds of gamers? I don't think so. Grand Theft Auto's demographic is mostly adolescent males, or the adolescent at heart, while The Sims' demographic is pretty much everyone else, which is obviously a bigger slice of the pie. It's the same reason why the Mario Brothers franchise is one of the most successful ever, because everyone can enjoy it. The fact that The Sims and Grand Theft Auto have sold so well over the years is a sign that there's strong demand for both types of games. The challenge that Grand Theft Auto faces, like first-person shooters, is that it needs to outdo itself with every new release. The original SimCity would still be entertaining today, but how long would a shoot-'em-up like Castle Wolfenstein, which was the Grand Theft Auto of its day, hold a teenager's attention today? Games revolving around sex and violence are primarily relying on advances in graphics and processing power in order to create more realistic blood splatters. Games revolving around problem-solving and social interaction are less at the mercy of hardware advancements because they rely less on video realism and more on the creativity of games designers. Moore's Law will ensure that gaming platforms keep becoming more powerful for a while yet. Once this plateaus, game designers will be forced to look beyond blood and gore to win market share. Perhaps in the long run, The Sims will outlive Grand Theft Auto. It will be interesting to see which games are making headlines when my son hits high school.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
They certainly are coming-of-age video games these days, don't you think? The graphics are just sensational, the processing power and the likes. But Adam certainly did nail a few concerns there.
He did. They've come a long way since we used to waste hours and hours at playing games against each other.
Warcraft.
Yes. What was that one where you used... Was that SimCity where you used to put the residential buildings and the commercial buildings,
the
industrial,
one.
And
yeah.
used to build roads and go yeah. chung, 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 chung.
You can get that on your mobile phone these days.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding. So if you're sitting there bored on the train on the way home and you're not listening to us,
that
you
was
can
great.
Go and play SimCity on your mobile.
You build fire stations and police stations and hospitals.
Absolutely.
That was great.
Certainly make you miss your stop on the train on the way out. I can't get off yet. I've got to sow more crops and feed more people
that's
so that
right.
I can have
that's
a bigger
right.
town and they can take over. Yeah. And then what happened? Then the recession came and they all died off because you didn't have any money for food or something
like
that.
Oh, yeah. We used to build nuclear power stations and coal-fired power stations. If there's so much pollution, you're in trouble. And you used to look at the maps. the overlay of the pollution areas and where there were electrical brownouts and it used to.
That's right, the brownouts.
Yeah, it used
that,
to become
yeah.
completely unsustainable and just fall apart.
Yes, there's a not moral. That, there's a lesson.
Yeah, not
in that,
that would
there?
Ever happen in real life in society. Thanks for the report, Adam. Very interesting.
It's very good. He was just saying that there's issues with Shoutcast at the moment. That's the Mac Haven these days for those.
Mac Haven.
Come and visit the window stream and you'll be
the
fine.
The irony.
Yeah. Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au if you have any contributions we'd like to hear from them. Our callers are standing by to take your email as we speak. Video on your iPod. This has been a sore contentious issue, and if Graham was here, he'd be going, I keep downloading things for a video on my iPod and it doesn't work.
Oh, really?
Well, customers of the Australia Video Easy and Blockbuster video rental stores will soon be able to take their iPods into a store. Well, you can do that now, but the benefit of it is that you can download a selection of rental videos onto it.
That's clever.
So rather than using bandwidth and your internet connection, you can just pop into the local Video Easy and Blockbuster shop.
And you drop it in a dock, do you?
Oh, I don't know. You must. And then you can watch these videos on your TV at home via your Video Easy set-top box. Ah, oh, here's the catch.
You need one of their set-top boxes.
Yes. Island-based ITV technology company Digisoft TV issued a press release at the NAB show, which is the National Association of Broadcasters in Las Vegas, which was earlier this month, saying that Video Easy had selected its IPTV, that's TV delivered over the internet protocol, a delivery platform and set-top box middleware to support the service, which would be rolled out into 1,000 Video Easy and Blockbuster stores in Australia and New Zealand.
I was wondering how they were going to do it, like in terms of the digital rights management and copy protection. They wouldn't just be able to give people movies that they could watch without any form of control.
Well, that's a contentious issue, isn't it? But look what happened to the model with
audio. They
should
be able to, but they wouldn't.
Well, they probably will, I think. You know, I think video is probably maybe 5, maybe 10 years behind where audio is now on the internet. And some people have removed DRM, digital rights management, from audio because everyone complained about it. Potentially, video will go the same way. And especially as the internet becomes so media rich with all these fantastic new video services that are online, like you do at home, Dr. Ron, you'll be able to use your media station. Just, what am I going to watch now? I'll connect to this server and watch this program.
Just start the streaming, please.
Absolutely. And as Adam alluded to in a couple of shows back, there is ABC Playback, which is about to hit here in Australia. It's in beta mode at the moment. But in essence, it targets people who miss something on the ABC. For those listening further afield, the ABC is our free-to-air broadcaster, the government-controlled free-to-air broadcaster in Australia, services the whole country. And what you can do with ABC Playback is you log in through your media center thing. We have a Tech Talk login there to do our testing and have a bit of a look-see. And what happens is you can download a program which has been on air, so you might have missed something.
Yeah, so
you
once it's been on broadcast, then it's made available.
And it sits up there for a month.
The internet.
Now, that's the theory anyway. It'll sit up there and you can say, oh, I really wish I saw that thing that was on the 7:30 report or on Late Line 2 weeks ago.
Well, and you can go to that program and you can watch it.
Yeah, you can log into ABC Playback and watch it. And that's where we're coming to. This is where the broadband side of things in this country needs to lift a bit because
where the commercials need to start to lift a bit as well.
Yeah, that's another story, isn't it? But the ABC have always done it exceptionally well in this country when it comes to the online world. But I think that's a fantastic service. And even the way Video Easy and Blockbuster are going, it's the same sort of model, just with the removal of the bandwidth in the middle.
Mm.
You know, instead of downloading it and taking, I don't know, if it's a simple compressed 700 meg, which is what a movie is these days on a DivX thing, and on an ADSL1 connection, that take you, what, maybe 30 minutes to download? We're thinking about it. A lot longer if you're on a lot slower.
So, yeah, but if you've got a super fast connection.
ADSL2, you probably do it in about 5 to 7 minutes or something like that. So this just means for those people who are bandwidth impaired that you'll be able to do it a little bit quicker.
Mm.
And that leads on to what Mr. Rudd's doing at the moment. The broadband in this country is sort of, they're looking at 12 megabits per second. So hopefully we're going to be sort of ramping that up a little bit more than 12 megabits per second as the new fiber to the node or whatever it is happens. The Prime Minister should be able to hopefully ramp it up a bit, I would have thought.
So when you started talking about Video Easy and Blockbuster and iPods, my first thought was that they're going to be making programs available in an iPod format so you could watch them while you're sitting on the train or going to work or having your lunch.
Well, this is what they do in the States now.
But what you're talking about there is they're just using the iPod as a storage device so you can take it away with you digitally.
And play it back. You can
play it back at home.
Into your Apple TV or whatever you've got.
Righto.
And play it into that sort of
format. So can you watch it on your iPod? Is it the right format?
I would imagine so. Yeah. Why wouldn't you be able to?
Yeah, that would be good.
Otherwise, you might as well take your flash disk in and whack it onto that and take it home.
That was going to be my next suggestion. Why wouldn't you rock on up to your Blockbuster or Video Easy with your USB hard disk, with your 320 gigabyte hard disk, which costs you $5.99 at your local grocery store, and you could stock up.
You could
say, I'm going to have a video night, and I'm going to put 5 or 6 or 7 movies or films on my storage device.
Well, according to DigiSoft, the service uses an in-store kiosk with stored movies. So it's obviously going to be a big red, orange, blue box in the corner, and you go and plug your iPod, and you dock it in, as you say.
Drop it in the dock.
And the consumer simply plugs the USB storage device or an iPod into the kiosk, so you can do either.
Ah, there you go, USB storage device or iPod.
And select the movies for download and playback later via the set-top box. So I think the catch to it is the set-top box that you have. So
maybe you can't watch it natively on the iPod.
No.
Now, have they launched this service yet, Andrew, or is it still pending?
It's coming up. It hasn't launched, but they're saying that they'll have it in rental shops soon. So I'd say by the end of the year, we'll be looking at this new thing. But once again, you look at consumers, we're all early adopters in this sort of high-tech world. But if you look at having to get a box from Video Easy or Blockbuster, and there's no mention of pricing or anything like that.
You've still got to leave the house. You've still got to get in your car. You've got to drive down the road.
What do you want to do? Become a recluse or something?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if I want to become a recluse, but do I want to spend time in video stores?
Social interactivity is a wonderful thing, talking to the people over the counter and bumping into other people in the video shop.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, good. Let's talk about Google.
Google revenues surged 42%.
As you said, recession?
Recession. What recession?
the world's largest search engine is obviously doing something right. So what are they doing, Dr. Ron?
$1.31 billion profit for the first quarter of this year. It's not too bad.
Yeah, the boys and girls at Mountain View are doing a sterling job.
They are. So their first quarter revenue totaled $5.19 billion.
Wow.
Which is up 42%, as you had in the notes there, Andrew, for the same time last year. And for the first time in its 9.5-year history, more than half of Google's revenue has come from outside the United States.
Well, the boss from Mr. Google, whose name eludes me, Schmidt.
Eric Schmidt,
there you go. He was in Australia recently singing the virtues of the Australian market to the Google empire, and they say we're a fairly valuable asset to have here. We must do a lot of internet sort of things, which obviously in turn generates some revenue.
Oh, that's good. That's very good. Good on Google. And analysts were worried about the effect that the US economy was going to have on their profits, but they were pleasantly surprised by the good reports, the good position that Google is quite clearly in.
It'd be interesting to see what happens in the US economy in recent times, especially with the technological sector. Like, they've got their NASDAQ over there, which is the indices of
the technology
IT
stocks.
Companies. Mm. Yeah. We're rumoured to get one of those in Australia here, which I'm not sure, still quite can't work out how they're going to get 20 on there, but nonetheless, they might. So
Google might be on there, might have Google Australia, might be a...
The guys in Sydney.
Yeah.
Wondering if they're going to have Developers Day for 2008. Went to one last year, if you remember, I was up in Sydney for Developers
Day. That's right, you had a ball.
That was terrific, but nothing out of the woodwork yet, so maybe it's a biannual event or every 2 years, whatever that is. So anyway. Spam. The world of spam. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, it does.
The amount of traffic on the World Wide Web these days with related to spam is just 90% plus in a lot of respects. I must admit,
this is email spam you're talking about?
Absolutely.
Or all spam?
Oh, a bit of everything, really.
Social networking spam.
Very big at the moment, especially in phishing, because everyone's still phishing. So they're using things like, Olympic Games emails and all that sort of stuff to try and...
Bendigo Bank, all the usual...
Sucker people in.
Yeah, usual phishing scams.
Absolutely.
Right at the moment.
Lydia Davis has a chat to Chris Boyd very shortly from FaceTime in relation to what they're doing. They're an organisation who had a... Well, actually, Chris was talking over at RSA in 2008, RSA 2008 convention in San Francisco recently. We're going to hear from him a little bit later on. But in the meanwhile, there's an interesting one caught my eye, as it would with anyone's eye. New spam outbreak says it sees you naked.
Oh, not again.
Oh, well, yes. Security vendor Marshall.
Told you to close the curtains.
Yeah, but that's not me. That's just someone who's painted
that's what you always
say.
It wasn't
body.
Me. It wasn't me. Exactly. It looks like me.
Security vendor Marshall is warning email users of a new mass targeted spam outbreak, which contains a personalized subject line claiming to have caught you Dr. Ron, naked. I'd be closing that and deleting it straight away if I got that.
It's a horrible thought.
It is.
Oh, dear.
The malicious campaign is being sent from Sribiz, S-R-I-Z-B-I, Sribi, however you pronounce that, botnet, identified as the largest spam-sending botnet on the internet.
Oh.
See, I should know how to pronounce that. That's a fairly notable record.
S-R-I-Z-B-I,
Sribi.
Sribi.
Yeah. Anyway, and it's responsible for 45% of all spam caught, according to Marshall's Trace Team.
Oh.
The message itself contains a clickable link which claims to be a naked video of the recipient and reads, "We caught you naked," and then insert your name here. That's in brackets, so you put your name
Dr.
there.
Dr. Ron.
Dr. Ron, yeah. Mm. Check the video. When the user clicks on the link, the PC becomes infected and enlists as a member of the botnet, as you would imagine, so that they can send out more of these little things. And that's one of the joys of botnets, really. They don't want you to know that you become infected because then they can use your machine at their will, not
it's
your will.
A drive-by hijacking site.
That's right. And it's becoming computer. Very, very popular. So everybody out there, make sure your antivirus stuff's all ramped up.
And you keep your clothes on with the webcams on.
And yeah, absolutely. And the other really simple thing is, if you're unsure, don't click it. It's like mobile phones, you know, the operating system in a mobile. You can only get your mobile infected if you click OK. And I can't remember, maybe a week or so back, we were talking about the fact that everybody gets inundated with these messages. Like, you're a Kaspersky user. I'm a Kaspersky user. That's an antivirus program. And a lot of these antivirus companies like to tell you what's going on, and rightly so. But after a while, those messages can come thick and fast, depending upon where you're getting your email from or which websites you're visiting. And it just takes that one accidental click of going allow,
accept,
without
allow.
Reading the fine print.
You get warning fatigue, don't you?
Yeah, you do. That's a good way of calling it, isn't it?
You just get accustomed to having pop-ups there all the time warning you about stuff. And in the end, you want to get the job done. You just keep clicking OK, keep clicking accept, keep clicking allow, and suddenly, before you know it,
we've got something nasty on the machine.
You're part of a large botnet.
And if you've got Kaspersky, that pig squealing at 2 in the morning is not good. He has a sound effect when something comes in.
If it detects a virus or something trying to install something against your explicit instructions, this loud pig noise squeals at
and
you.
It is. It wakes the whole house at 2 in the morning,
does,
trust me. It
frightens the willies out of you.
All right, time for a break. Back with more in a moment.
You're listening to TechTalk Compelling.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Judicious.
The question is really whether young people particularly are addicted to being connected to other people all the time.
Historical.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history. This is the day, the 6th of October, 2006, that life in Australia will be changed forever.
Caring.
I know as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school. How can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
You heard of road rage? What about web rage?
They should be wearing a mask and carrying a gun.
Relations between Telstra and the federal government have been extremely strained almost from the moment Sol Trujillo became chief executive.
Optus had, again, had quite a good quarter, but its 3G service is very low profile at the moment.
And the Queen's got an iPod.
Betty's got one.
Yeah.
I wonder what she listens to. She'll probably listen to us.
An unexpectedly high number of voters swamped the system. Well, what did they expect?
Controversial.
Less attention is paid to the equally interesting question, should journalists blog?
Magical.
And I've got some residual powers.
Ambitious.
High-speed broadband, it's available in most of Asia as well as being in the rest of the world. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
Religion.
Talking of the Roman Catholics, I have been on Vatican Radio.
Comedy.
You put the date on ePray, it goes, and you get a whole service. Just on. How does it go? It goes.
Insightful, entertaining, and informative. Tech Talk Radio. More than just technology.
It's a strictly rehearsed and finely polished program.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Hey, welcome back to TikTok Radio. Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron here this evening. Panel of two. I think we're churning through it all right this evening.
Oh, we're getting there.
Lots to talk about,
though. We don't do a bad job. There's always lots to talk about.
We mentioned Google earlier on in the piece, and yes, Google Earth 4.3 offers better navigation. So, yeah, there you go.
How does it offer better navigation?
Google has updated its Google Earth mapping application, offering 3D navigation systems which the company claims is smoother and more natural for users. I thought it was pretty good to start with.
It was very good to start with.
Click your KMZ file and down you went.
That's right, the KMZ files. That's what they use to save out location information.
Yeah. Now, this is Google Earth as opposed to Google Maps. Google Earth is an application which you download from Google and put on your machine, and you just run it up as you choose. So whereas if you wanted to interact with things a little bit more, you can go to maps.google.com.au or any variation thereof. Australia and the rest of the world's all covered, and you just type in your address. Type in Tech Talk Radio. I don't know what comes up if you type in Tech Talk Radio, but you can type up anything and the little map will then take you down. You zoom down into the map. So
I've got Google Earth loaded on my Windows machine at home. I've also got Google Earth loaded on my Ubuntu machine.
Have you?
Hmm.
Does it work all right on Ubuntu?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
It's a rip snorter.
Oh, very good. I like rip snorters. They're good, aren't they?
It works very well. It works faultlessly on Ubuntu. I haven't upgraded it for a while, so I might have a look and see what the versions I've got installed.
Likewise. I tend to use Maps on the web browser, maps.google.
Yeah, do it all online.
Yeah. Mm. Among the new navigation tools in Google Earth 4.3 is a modified zooming feature where users zoom in from the full Earth view. The 3D map will zoom in normally as the view zooms closer to the ground. However, the perspective tilts in a manner that sort of, you know, how sort of parachuting to the ground. Sort of as you get to the ground, it sort of does a bit of a, how would you call it? How would you describe it? As you get closer to the ground, it does a bit of a tilt for you.
Does a bit of a tilt.
Yes. The engineers are working, obviously, what can we do differently this time?
Have you used Google Maps on your mobile phone?
You have.
We were playing around with it on your mobile.
I've been playing and using in my vocabulary are two different things.
Yep.
But I haven't actually, you know, summoned up the courage to seek advice on how to get from A to B on my Google Maps and the mobile phone. Another thing, when I was talking to on the phone to the States the other day, to Rico, he was sort of saying that they use, what do you call the Wi-Fi networks? Those really intense little low area networks, as opposed to like a GSM or WiMAX or anything like that, to actually do their navigation,
right,
sort of to work out where you are.
Yep.
I said, well, that's really good if you're in a city centre, but what if you're in the countryside somewhere?
Mm.
You know, here in Australia, we've got a bit of open space where there's not, you don't have much Wi-Fi out there, I wouldn't have thought.
So. No, that's right. I was going to try and find the address for the Google Maps for your mobile. I've got it on my mobile phone from here. I'll
have
a look at it a bit later
during
a break.
Like,
yeah, we'll get that address for people, because it's a lot of fun. It works very well. Just as you can use Google Maps on your PC, you can just dial it up if you've got a mobile phone that's connected to the internet, like a 3G type phone or 2.5G with GPRS. You can access Google Maps.
Simon has used the SMS texting device this evening. He's had his phone and he's texted us on our mobile voice, what do you call it? The text number? 0430-582077.
Hi, Simon. It's the electronic texting system.
He has. It says a very short message because that's what SMS allows you. I remember when I had my first GSM handset, the manual said it had SMS capabilities.
Oi.
I tried to ask the carriers about this, so the reply was, who would use that?
Yes. It wasn't switched on till about here, until about 1997.
And it was originally built as a texting thing to let people know you had a voicemail,
maybe
wasn't
even
it?
A bit later. Yeah, well, the networks here thought, we'll use it as a message waiting indicator. We'll send text messages from the network back to subscribers' handsets so they know that there's a voicemail message waiting.
Little did they know what sort of a rake in the money type sort of thing it's going to be.
That's just it.
They probably earn more money from SMS than they do on voice calls these days.
Now, because there's some people that just live on sending text messages.
And you think about
30 or 40, 50 a day.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Oh, well, that's the youth coming to.
Youth.
All right. Voice biometrics touted for financial services. Now, this is potentially good. We were talking about earlier in the show about how you can use your voice to potentially dial a phone and do all that sort of. Well, we do that now, don't we?
Mm.
That's sort of, we've all had a bit of fun playing with that in the car, you know.
You use that a lot in the car?
I used to. It got me into trouble, then I turned it off.
Yeah. That's because you had expletives set up in people's memories, didn't you?
No,
so if someone
no.
cut you off, it would say, dialing, Dr. Ron.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. But anyway, voice biometrics for financial services, this has got to be good. The financial services industry should consider voice biometrics as a more secure and convenient method of multi-factor authentication for phone or online banking, which makes good sense, really, doesn't it? Voice biometrics from VCommerce said this week that the case for the voice biometrics is further strengthened with the recent introduction of an ISO global standard for deploying biometrics in financial services. this has got to be good. We've sort of now got a standard to do all this sort of stuff.
Interesting. VE Commerce are a very well-known, very highly respected organisation in the speech recognition and interactive voice response industries.
The other thing too, voice recognition's got a something about it, isn't it? It's your voice, isn't it? It's not the next person's voice, and it's very hard to impersonate a voice. Well, there's some impressionists out there, but even still, it's probably not a very skillful art to impersonate somebody. Brett Felden, who works for this organisation, VE Commerce, said, over a quarter of the UK population now regularly uses online banking, but fraud continues to increase, and the criminals are becoming more sophisticated with their attack. And over the past 12 months, many financial institutions have rolled out card readers. I've got one of those on my key ring. You get them from the Commonwealth Bank, little numbery thing. As a solution for providing second factor authentication for online banking customers.
Mm.
But even these have had, you know, attacks and several drawbacks because, you know, you just got to find the right serial number or something. And I guess they've got little computers to generate the numbers. But hey, it's still a bit more of an obstacle.
Well, people are looking at introducing alternatives because to security, because at the moment we've got IVRs where we can access our bank account details. We ring a phone number, we put in an account number, we might put in a PIN, and we've got complete access to our bank accounts and all our financial records. And all we're doing is just typing in an account number and a password, and we're using this DTMF tones on a keypad. What this is doing is providing a second level of security, so they're actually listening to the subtle frequencies in your voice, in your spoken voice over the phone. They think they might ask you a question, which maybe one of 10 questions or one of a few questions that only you would know the answer to. Things like mother's maiden name, first dog's name, the name of the first street you lived in. And we'll ask you these randomly as, in addition to asking you for PIN numbers when you're logging in. And it just provides another level of security. The other thing that they're doing, similar to what you're saying, Andrew, you've got that key ring thing.
Yes.
And the other, and there's a bank here in Melbourne as well. It's trialling the SMS system. So it will actually text you a temporary session password or password if you're accessing your banking details over the internet, like on the web browser.
Yep.
And you have to actually key that in. So if people do somehow come across your username and your password or your log-on details, you do need another level, or there is another level of security in place there to protect you.
Jason Sterling from Genesis Australia. These guys make this technology. And he was on our show recently. Did you know? Were you here for that one, or was that one of the nights that you had a, please excuse me, the doctor's
sick night? I think I had the, yeah, had a note from the mum night.
Jason will be returning to Tech Talk Radio in probably about 3 weeks' time, I think.
Excellent.
And we're going to be talking more about this sort of stuff. But he was on the show recently, and we talked about just this very situation, voice identification, or identifying you by voice, because it is, it's very, very unique part of your identity, you know, even more so than a fingerprint or a retinal scan or something like that. And just how impractical are those sort of things? Well, your voice, you've got it with you every time, even if you've got a cold, even if you're not feeling too flash, you've got a croaky voice like poor old Graham, then as a result, you know, it can still identify you. You know what it is. Here's just a little grab when we were talking to Jason about voice recognition and banking.
One of the big things that we are working on, two projects right now, but I can't say who they are, but we're working on speech-based biometrics, which is pretty cool.
How close are we to being actually identifiable by our voice patterns?
From a technology perspective, we are really close.
Yeah.
As I mentioned, we are working through two pilot projects at the moment with, again, they're significant enterprises in Australia, and there are a couple, there are projects going on around the world that are using biometrics. So like your retina or your fingerprint, your voice is individual to anyone. So, and you, apparently I can speak like this or I can speak like this, and apparently there are voice waves.
Yeah,
there are waves, and that's me. And I can say my voice, I can say something when I've got a cold, I can say a string of words, and there's something unique about my vocal cords that individual, and apparently that's even more successful. The federal agencies in the US will say you'll get higher security ratings than for a fingerprint, because a fingerprint can, you know, have cuts or whatever on it, whereas your voice apparently is extremely secure. And there's lots of neat things when you get into these, you know, we're discovering these projects, and, you know, there's challenge questions, because yes, you could tape record me saying my mother's maiden name or whatever, something like that. So, you know, there's all these cool things like I'll give you a challenge question that's completely irrelevant. You know, what football team you back for? And the answer doesn't actually matter whether you get it right or wrong, but as long as you can encourage...
And the combination of getting the question right and recognising your voice,
bingo. So as you see with this, you can build up something that's extremely secure. I mean, it depends on the purpose. It also depends on the transaction. You know, if you're transacting a $10 or a $20 DVD or something like that, you might not care. But if you're transacting something to do with mortgage repayments or something like that, you want to authenticate.
Mm. But that would be very cool if you rang up a business and said, I've got a billing inquiry. And they said, hello, Jason. Yes, we'll put you through to billing now.
I recognise you. Yes. You know what? I would love that. I know some people worry about privacy and that, but if I could ring, you know, if I could ring the bank on the way home in the car and just say, hi.
What's my balance?
Well, nearly said who the bank was. Hi, whatever. You know, it's Jason here. I want to pay my credit card. Oh, hi, Jay. Wouldn't that be cool?
Wouldn't that be cool?
It would. It would be very cool.
It's where we're going, though, don't you think? Mm. You know, as Rico was alluding to with mobile phones, being able to voice dial and do stuff like that, authentication, the voice has got to be it.
Yeah.
Better than everything else.
In terms of privacy, your identity still has to be established in some way to be able to do business with people over the telephone. So whether that happens by pressing buttons, which people can write down and lose and copy and distribute, or whether it happens through a secure method, like a biometric method.
Absolutely. And it saves time, too.
I know which one I'm going to prefer.
Too, right. Saves time, because if you think about it, if I ring you, normally you disperse with the pleasantries and you just get straight into your conversation. You know who it is just by the sound of their voice.
That's it.
It's got to have so many things going for it, I would have thought. Mm. Darren has just emailed us from the UK. UK? From Manila.
Hi, Darren.
And just said the UK ID card has triple authentication.
Ah.
Triple authentication. I'm not sure what the ID card is. Is that like your Medicare card or...
I don't know. We'll have to find out. Tell us what it is, Darren. Fingerprints, your
social security card or something like that. I don't know, but anyway. All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ron Andrew McComb in the panel this evening. Boffins promise a 500 gig half... I wish I could talk.
Try that again.
Let me go half a terabyte. That's probably easier to say, isn't it?
500,000 gigabyte iPod.
Yeah. What do you reckon?
That's every song in the world twice, isn't it?
Absolutely. No need for DRM on that.
No.
So, a nanotechnology breakthrough at the University of Glasgow.
Oh, no, I'm not looking at your notes. Is this new racetrack memory?
I don't know. The Glasgow guys would pave the way for an MP3 player with a storage capacity 150,000 times greater than today's top-of-the-range devices. Researchers claim to have developed a molecular-sized switch which dramatically boosts storage capacity without the need to increase the physical size of players.
Okay.
The technology could see a 500,000 gigabyte crammed into a square-inch microchip, allowing users to store hundreds of millions of video clips and music tracks on a single device, well in excess of the 40,000 songs on today's largest capacity players.
That's crazy stuff.
The other good thing, that'd get rid of compression, wouldn't it? And you'd have real music again in your ears. None of this watery blah, blah, blah stuff that
it'd
you
be
get.
The end of MP3s. We'd go back to good old uncompressed waveform.
Oh, wouldn't that be great? It with would. Bandwidth to go with it.
It would.
The breakthrough undertaken with the college at Daresbury Laboratory. Whoop, laboratory. Sorry, there's a Freudian slip.
In Washington, probably got a lavatory as well. That's all right, though.
Using giant X-ray machines could also transform storage on other consumer electronics, including DVD players. So watch our Blu-ray will be usurped in next to no time. Something to look forward to, don't you think, Dr. Ron?
I think so. There's a new memory system that people are researching as well. I was reporting on it last week, I think, called Racetrack Memory.
Racetrack Memory. Yeah. I need wife memory. She can remember everything that I don't want her to remember. See, that's what you need, isn't it?
Needs to be able to erase.
And one of our listeners, GD, he kept washing his memory too. Like I wash phones. He washed memories.
Put all his memory sticks through
the washing
machine.
You need resilient memory, don't you?
Resilient memory is
absolutely
what you need.
Absolutely. On this note, it's time for a break.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
The 3G offering in Optus is still very much by stealth.
That's right.
I'm going to throw you an advertising point
of view. I'm a technician. What do you want me to do?
Do you know anyone who still uses a modem?
I've got a test page up on the root of the domain.
Yeah. What's that about? How does that help me get on the phone?
The Androids are coming. Did you know?
Androids.
A lot of unhappy campers.
Probably best if you go to the web and have a look.
Yes.
No.
I'm going for the job.
Yeah, sorry. Yes.
Have you got enough spare time? Why don't you?
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
And something now for our Macintosh users, because we don't want to be leaving them out.
No, we're not. We're streaming for Macintosh and everything.
Absolutely. Yeah. Apple, Adam, take note. Apple patches critical Safari holes. If you're a web browsing Safari type person, Apple has patched 4 security vulnerabilities in Safari affecting the OS X and Windows version of the web browser. That VoiceWare found its way to my machine, by the way, Graham, if you're listening. I've got Safari on my XP box now.
Have you?
Yes. I forgot to uncheck the box.
You're the one. Oh, it's appeared.
Yes.
You won't be the only one now, because they're installing it by stealth, aren't they?
Absolutely.
They started doing that.
And then it starts annoying you, saying, do you want me to become your default browser? And you go, no. Where did you come from?
But why would it say that? Why are you running it up? Are you deliberately starting it, or is something else starting it on your behalf?
Why am I starting it? No. When that upgrade-y MPEG thing that they have, QuickTime, when it asks you to upgrade iTunes and QuickTime goes with it, I need QuickTime for what I do for a living.
And you get a Safari pop-up as well saying, do you want to make this
in the
top browser?
It's in a text box, so I thought, installed in my box now, I might as well use it. So,
yep.
There you go.
Have you got text in all your menus the first time you tried it?
Yeah, I do now. I do now.
I'm going to fix
I've
that.
I've got text. Yeah, it's good. You can actually see what you're doing, so...
Yes. Very good. Now, I had some feedback as well for the Google Maps on your mobile.
Yeah.
The address is mobile.google.com.
That makes sense, really, doesn't it?
Yeah. Browse to that address.
On your mobile?
On your mobile phone.
You've done this on mine, haven't you?
I have.
I saw you do it the other day.
I have, and it will actually detect what type of mobile device you have, and it will download and install the appropriate installer for your mobile phone.
Paper, that's a fairly old analog form of communications. Would you agree, Dr. Ron?
Yeah, it's going to be with us for some time yet, however.
Who knows? Electronic paper is Japan's answer to the rising raw material costs, depending upon resources and booming demand for printed matter from emerging markets, such as China and India,
right?
Would you know? At a high-tech fair in Tokyo last week, Japanese firms showed the latest version of what is still considered a niche product, ranging from thick, sturdy readers to thin displays that look like plastic sheets and can be bent. E-Ink, for want of a better term, E-Ink.
E-Incorporated or E-Ink as in what
electronic
you...
Electronic ink, I reckon. E-Ink.
Dip your quill in.
Quill?
As in the bottle.
No quill here,
ink,
my
ink
friend.
Bottle.
E-Ink, which manufacturer Sony's reader tablet says consumers will eventually embrace the energy-saving technology as the cost of paper and fuel goes up.
Ah.
So what do you reckon? Electronic paper, has it got half a chance? Hard to photocopy, but then you could probably just print and put a hard copy out anyway.
Yeah.
However that works.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know. Tablet PCs.
There's a couple of them on the market, isn't
there? Yeah, they never really took off, did they?
Well, once again, a great idea, but I just think the consumers need to adapt to them or adopt them.
Well, people were going to walk around with those sorts of things instead of notepads.
Isn't there one? This
scribbles straight onto the screen.
One manufacturer has a screen that sort of does a backflip somersault and just displays in front of you, so the keyboard goes and you just get a little tablet. Which makes me wonder, have you seen those people with those PDAs, those Palm Pilots, with those funny little pens? Oh, that'd be so frustrating, I couldn't handle that. You've got one, haven't you? You can actually write on it. I've seen you write on yours.
Do I? Yeah, I do. Yeah, the
obviously, you're not using it.
Oh, no, I do. I use it more as a PDA, though. It's it's got inbuilt telephone and all sorts of things.
But do you
stuff,
write on it?
I do. Yeah, it uses the graffiti language.
What's graffiti?
Graffiti alphabet. It's a particular way of actually scrawling with a stylus.
Yeah.
So that it recognises the letters that you're writing.
Mm. Okay. Well, let's see what happens. Electronic paper, and whether it's got half a chance.
Mm.
The ACCC is the organisation in this country that keeps an eye on consumers.
Are they using
thingy bobs?
Are they using electronic paper?
No. They're not. They're keeping an eye on eBay at the moment.
Right. So that wasn't the link at all.
No.
Okay.
No. None whatsoever. It was a cut point for Graham. Why the ACCC cannot grant eBay Australia a request for PayPal online only payments? Now, do you remember last week we were talking about how
they
PayPal
cannot grant the request?
No. Basically, what's happening in Australia is that PayPal are trying this market as a PayPal only device for eBay.
If you buy something on eBay.
They're going to force
you. If you're an eBay merchant, I think it was.
Yeah, up until recently, you've been able to use direct bank account deposits and things like that.
And private people buying and selling stuff could still do that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But if you're actually...
And there's certain exemptions like cars and boats and big dollar value, big dollar ticket value things.
Mm.
But anyway, there's been a few people sort of making a bit of a ruckus about this. Oh, this isn't fair, table stomping and all that sort of stuff. The ACCC just basically came out the other day and said, well, it's nothing to do with us.
Oh, so they've said they've got no power.
The role of the ACCC is to regulate for free and open competition in the marketplace and to protect consumers. There is a viable competitor to PayPal that provides eBay consumers. Sorry, let me read that again. There is a viable competitor to PayPal that protects eBay consumers. That is just one reason why the ACCC cannot allow the intention of eBay Australia to accept payments only through its PayPal subsidiary. There you go. I might have misled. It's the other way around.
Oh, so eBay, sorry, the ACCC have said that they can't do that.
Yeah.
They can't prohibit people, for merchants from...
Yeah, because there's competition in the marketplace, and if PayPal do that, then they're going to quell or quash those poor people.
That might upset eBay.
It might. Maybe they'll have to try New Zealand or another market, a small...
As a trial.
Pacific market for them or something. Fiji, maybe. They can go out there and say, no, no, no. But there you go. I just think it's going to be interesting what happens as these large corporations try to inflict their ways on us.
Mm.
Thank you to the ACCC for looking after us and all that sort of stuff too, I reckon. They're keeping the consumer in a little bit of a safety net around everybody so we don't get taken for a ride.
I haven't been eBay surfing for a long time.
You haven't bought anything?
No.
I use PayPal religiously.
With eBay or just...
Just in general.
Just in general?
I actually... Because you can actually get a little application now which puts a pay me now button on your emails.
Yeah.
So when you want to harass a client for payment and make them feel really bad that they haven't paid you, you can put a little PayPal button on there and they can pay you instantly from an email. It's really good. You should try it.
That's quite clever, isn't it?
It is. It's amazing what you can do these days thanks to those sort of guys. All right, Chris Boyd, FaceTime. Lydia Davis had a chat to him at the RSA convention the other day. They watch out for all sorts of nasty things that sneak into your social networking site, Web 2 sort of stuff, general, that sort of feel of things, because it's all about security. And we'll just cross over there and have a chat and see what Lyd found out, and we can learn something. So if you're a Facebook user...
I am.
Well, yes, you should listen to this.
Christopher, welcome to the show.
Cheers, thanks.
Tell me about FaceTime.
Yeah, FaceTime is a company that makes and produces tools and programs that defend against peer-to-peer attacks, instant messaging, and they also defend against sort of spyware attacks. So there's a core sort of anti-spyware component to it as well. And in addition to those things, with regards to the product, we also track down the people who create these infections and things like that, and we try and shut them down by working with law enforcement or the security companies. And various other entities that I'm not allowed to talk about.
Are you allowed to go and smack them?
The bad guys, or?
Yeah, the bad guys. They stick.
Yeah, they get a smacking on the internet. So,
so with Web 2.0 social media, are you finding any challenges that normally would not exist?
I mean, I actually find a lot of the time the Web 2.0 sites are actually incredibly useful tools for security researchers, because a lot of these people who create these things, they've been on social networking sites since the beginning. They've got their own MySpace page or their own Zanga, things like that. And a lot of the times they leave a paper trail, if you will, online, that you can use to track them back to base. You can find out when they started doing their nefarious activities online. You can find out things like they've abandoned old profiles and they've got their name and their age. Sometimes they've got their address. There's normally photographs of themselves and all their friends in their social circle. Sometimes other hackers are obviously on their friends list, so you can track them through those profiles as well.
So you hunt them down that way?
Yeah. So there's a lot of churn involved, because at the same time that a lot of these guys are trying to exploit people on sites like MySpace and Facebook and all the rest of it, you can also turn that around to your advantage, because a lot of these kids and hackers and older people that are doing these things online, they have to, a lot of the times, be on these sites in the first place to understand them intimately enough to be able to exploit them. So I hate cliches, but it's the old double-edged sword thing.
What do you find are the most common exploits?
Probably phishing. It's not technically an exploit, but in terms of the most popular thing, say with regards, definitely MySpace at the moment, you get kids as young as 10, 11 who routinely have competitions with each other to see who can phish the most accounts. And, they'll give each other reputation points for so many thousand. We're not talking like 10 or 12 pages. We're talking like they'll steal routinely hundreds or thousands of accounts, and they'll brag about how many they've got. Some of them will use automated tools. Some of them will create these phish pages manually. And, there's a lot of data. There's a lot of information stolen. And obviously, if those profiles have got private pictures on or other data stored behind the scenes, that's all up for grabs as well. And then that becomes distributed and all the rest of it.
Are they distributing it? Are they distributing the information? Or is it just a reputation?
It wasn't so long ago. I think it was something crazy like 800 gigs or something stupid, like some ridiculous figure of data that was being stolen from MySpace. There was something that allowed bad guys to suck down all the photographs that were supposedly private on people's profiles, and then this was just uploaded into file sharing networks. And you know, I don't think it's humanly possible to download the whole file as one entity. It's like gigs and gigs and gigs of data, and it's just all these people's stolen photographs, personal photographs, and all the rest of it. And obviously MySpace have fixed that now, but that's just one small example. Well, small example, that's one huge, huge example of a small aspect of the way that you can gain these networking sites, and why you shouldn't really put anything on there in the private sections that you don't really want to get out there, because there's no guarantee that it won't. Someone could find something tomorrow and just feed it to the whole world.
This is one of the things I've been asked about, is Facebook, and isn't it a wonderful thing because it's locked up behind a password?
I mean, the thing with gated social networking sites is the fact that, like, so for example, Google's Orkut, very popular, and I had this idea that actually the gated community and the fact that you've got to invite your friends into it, it sometimes gives you a false sense of security, because you think it's hidden away, no one can see it and no one can access it. And at the time I was looking at Orkut, we discovered the first worm on the Orkut network. This was back in 2006, I think it was, and it was unlike the ones that have come since then, that, you know, they spread quite a bit. They weren't malicious, they didn't steal data. People seem to have forgotten about this original worm that was on there in 06, that it was stealing people's data from the bank accounts. It would put something on the PC, and it was a huge problem for people in Brazil. I mean, I still get emails. I mean, Google went off and fixed it, but I still get emails from people now who are in Brazil who thank me for the fact that we tracked it down, we found out how it worked, and we worked with Google to get it fixed, because they'd had family members who'd lost money and the bank accounts being cleaned out and all sorts of things. So
you found that?
Yeah, we discovered that.
How?
Long story.
That's
basically, I was following leads and exploring social networking sites anyway, and I'd heard rumours that there was something going around on Orkut, and it wasn't too hard to find the source of the infection, but it was incredibly difficult to make it send the infection link across the Orkut network. So we tested it and tested it and tested it, tried all sorts of different things to get this thing to work, and it wouldn't. It was, for whatever reason, it was being very stubborn. And then at the 11th hour, we actually made this thing work, and then we knew that there was a problem and it had to be fixed. We went to Google with it, and they went off and fixed the problem and all the rest of it.
How long did it take you to find that?
Oh, that's a good question. From start to finish, because I was actually in America at the time working with some of the guys that are in my team, so it's difficult to say, really. It was a space of a week or two from the point where I think I heard there was something going on to the point where we actually got the thing to send the infection across the network.
Walk me through what a worm is.
Basically, a worm is just something that can spread on its own with no outside intervention. But it gets quite muddy, because some people will class something as a worm that might require some intervention, like a lot of IM worms. We call them worms, but someone's still got to click the link to download the infection file, and then if it's an exploit, it might try and run on its own. I mean, I think so many of these threats now are blended, and they're sort of these Frankenstein creations that have got a piece of a rootkit here and a piece of this malware there, and there's some adware in it. And I think a lot of the old sort of more traditional definitions have long since sort of ceased to be useful, really.
What's the most challenging exploit you've come across recently?
The most recent exploit we came across was something on MySpace, which it's a little bit convoluted to explain, but in terms of a threat to a regular MySpace user, to me it wasn't as big a deal as it was to the people that use MySpace to track bad guys. So, for example, you get a lot of law enforcement on MySpace, you get a lot of security researchers like myself on MySpace, and various other people who there's like anti-paedophile groups on MySpace that, you know, will track down paedophile profiles and then report it to the police and then come and shut them down. So what I found was that in MySpace, everyone's got like a video page and you've got a photograph page and all the rest of it. There was a piece of code that you could put on your MySpace profile so that if someone visits your MySpace profile while you've got this code on it, they would be automatically subscribed to your video subscription channel. So it'd be like they saw your videos and go, oh, that's interesting, I'll subscribe to their videos because I love their videos. So they wouldn't know that they'd been subscribed to it unless they went into their subscription list and thought, hang on, why am I subscribed to that guy? The person has to put this code on their page, however, they can go to their subscription list and they will see anyone who's logged in on their MySpace profile that has visited their page. So if you think about the implications of this, if I'm tracking a group of hackers and I've tracked them back to their MySpace pages and all the rest of it, and I'm pulling all this valuable information down. They all they've got to do is go to their subscriptions list and they'll see Chris Boyd has been sniffing around on their profile, and then they can go underground, they can take retaliatory action and all the rest of it. If I'm a paedophile on MySpace and, you know, I'm on there and I'm looking around for victims and all the rest of it, and I see all of a sudden I see officer whoever of whichever force, because police officers on MySpace generally have they're very upfront that I'm a police officer, this is my page, and the idea is that they will add themselves to the kids in that, like, their local town, so it like wards off paedophiles, because they'll go to those profiles, see a policeman on there, think, oh no, not touching that, go away. There's been a lack of communication, I think it's fair to say, and security researchers have always had a problem going to sometimes the social networking sites and getting something fixed or looked at. And they were very quick, and they came back and said, you know, we're going to fix this. And at the moment, they're testing various types of code to stop this. There is quite an incredibly simple, straightforward fix to stop yourself from being added to the subscribers list. So
on an individual level?
Yeah, on your own PC, you basically just add the MySpace domain that's responsible for videos and things to your hosts file, so it's blocked. So you cannot be subscribed to these videos.
What about Facebook?
Facebook is coming under closer scrutiny, I suppose, by bad guys. The only recent thing, really, was the thing where, again, it was to do with private pictures of yourself and things like that. There was, like, code you could type in at the top of your browser bar that would allow you to see pictures that were supposedly hidden, I think, as long as that person would... As long as you had the profile ID for someone that was on their friend list, you could add that in and then add theirs in and fiddle with it a bit, and then you could see all these pictures that all these people were in together. That's the only real thing that springs to mind, to be honest.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
100 million websites. What's this about?
The 100 million website mark has been cracked.
Really? TTR.mobi?
Correct.
Can I ask a question?
You just did ask me another one.
Is it safe to say you're a happy camper now?
Yes.
Oh,
I'm
good.
Happy. I'm a happy camper.
That sounds plausible. I haven't ever done it, but yeah, that sounds plausible.
We run PHP and MySQL on our Windows boxes.
They've changed the little antenna to the new HSDPA one.
Could you really be touching radio antennas while you're using...
Oh, back to serious stuff. Between my two servers, when it syncs, it's sort of had a daylight saving hemorrhage. And
I'll get that fixed for you, Mark.
That'd be great.
Mm.
Thanks, Dr. Ron.
2 megabit downlink for absolutely nothing out of Orange, I think it is, in the UK.
The salacious address sex.com sold for $12 million.
$12 million.
It's not a bad price to get for a domain name, is it?
If your machine breaks up and blows up and you want to build a new one, you get a second go.
Yeah, but if you've got kids, they're always crashing it.
I mean, kids. I've got a wife.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
You're a Facebook user. Did you learn anything then? Quite interesting, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was interesting. It's always a concern just how much personal information you put online. It's a usability versus security issue, and it always boils down to that. How useful and usable do you want your site to be and all your information to be? And
then who can get at that?
And who can get at that?
Mm.
How good is the security that's in place?
Employers block Facebook at their peril. This was an article in one of the local rags the other day, which sort of caught my eye as it went past. Companies seeking to attract young workers should think twice before limiting access to social networking sites during business hours.
We popped this in the news, Andrew. It was a study by Galaxy Research.
I thought this was hilarious, really? You want the young people to work for you? Make sure you don't block their social networking sites.
Well, that's right. They think that it actually adds to productivity. People... In this
You're
day
kidding.
And age, no,
really?
No, they like to keep connected, they like to network, and they like to always be in touch, and that aids productivity.
Well, yeah, maybe, in the lunch break, maybe. I don't know how to work in my organisation, but nonetheless, that's good. Who's online at the moment? Have you checked yours?
No, I can. Hang on a minute.
Mad Lid's probably still in the library. Oh, no, maybe she's not.
No, she went to the library and she went to the supermarket and
Absolutely.
Never came back.
Happy birthday, Martin.
I sent my last tweet on Twitter.
Did you?
Yes, my last tweet was... It's been
so long, and thanks for
yeah,
all the
it
fish.
Was. It's been fun. See you later. I'll, if anyone needs me, I'll be over on Facebook. And I think that's the last tweet that I twittered through Twitter.
All right. So you're not a Twitter person.
No, I can see why people use it. I can see that it has its place. But
social networking via SMS, I call it.
Well, it is. Yeah,
yeah. It is. All right. Good. Mm. Apple. You know how PCs ended up being pirated and ended up coming out with IBM clones and things like that?
Yeah, and then they just became a generic architecture.
Yeah, absolutely. The first unsanctioned Mac clone has hit the market, and it won't be the last.
Ooh.
It is hard to imagine the day that Apple moved to Intel architecture that the company didn't see this coming, which is true because Intel platforms, you know, out there. The question is, how will Apple stop the floodgates from opening? From the instant stories surfaced on the web recently, we're getting Mac clones now. Is that it was sort of coming, wasn't
interesting.
It?
Interesting. Will they be cheaper than the Apple Macs? I'm hoping they will be.
Absolutely,
that
was the thing with the
no
IBM
demand
clones,
for them if
it?
They were dearer.
We had to have clones because they were cheaper because you weren't paying the proprietary IBM. You know,
IBM badging.
What happened there? They just forgot to patent the right things. Is that how that went?
I don't know.
Oh, well, there's little doubt that the Apple already has put its legal team to work on shutting down the Mac OS X-related marketing activities of Cytar, I think it is, and it will certainly succeed. The problem for Apple is that Pandora's box is now open.
Good luck with that, yeah.
Absolutely.
If there are companies offshore that start churning out millions of these boxes, then even if they do manage to shut them down, the damage might be already done.
And finally tonight, before we go to the Oddspot Gadget and Website of the Week, users demand the choice of either XP or Vista well beyond June 30.
Mm.
Microsoft's plan to stop general sales of the Windows XP to anyone that wants it by June 30 this year is running into a roadblock. Customers don't want to go, or at least not yet anyway. Will the consumer backlash and customer demand on Microsoft make it so is the question, really, isn't it? With Vista, a lot of people actually, that's another thing, sorry, I digress, sitting on the fence waiting for Windows 7 to come along, and they're not going to go to Vista.
I think they're going to leapfrog Vista entirely.
Everyone's heard so many strange things about it, but you've got to ask the question, why is everyone not going to Vista? Have you got any Vista boxes?
I don't have any Vista boxes.
Do you know
boxes.
Anyone who's running Vista?
No, I do not.
It's funny, isn't it?
Everybody I know is firmly entrenched in XP. XP is a great operating system. It works very well. It's very stable.
I reckon Microsoft shot itself in the foot because it built such a good system in XP.
Well, they did. And people,
if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, and there's not that much incentive to go to Vista.
This is the problem.
You need more power and more grunt, and some of your apps aren't going to run
this
it
is
because
the problem.
It's too
you need,
new.
You need a really, really compelling event, a real compelling motivation to move, especially to change something as fundamental as an operating system. And at the moment, it's just not there in Vista.
All right. Send us your thoughts. feedback@techtalkradio.com.au. We'll be back with the closing of the show after this.
You're listening.
Dr. Ron?
Here I am listening.
Residual power. And I've got some residual
power. You can't turn off CDMA.
Listen.
In terms of the volume,
motorists have to give fingerprints. Now, this
we may have digressed.
Talk radio.
Bill Burgess also claimed the country would remain behind.
We used to think 600
don't open things that good that you're not expecting, even if they do appear.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
Cool! This thing is amazing!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Out of my own!
This week's gadget landed in our feedback email inbox during the week. Yes. I thought, what a clever little device. The TrackStick 2 personal GPS tracker. Track sticks are tiny GPS location recorders capable of continuously logging their own location histories for extended periods of time. You're right over there, Dr. Andrew. Dr. Andrew's just—he's actually physically swallowed his microphone. He's trying to
come on,
compose
back to
himself.
It, back to it.
There we are. You're back on air.
Yeah, thanks.
The track stick records its own location, time, date, speed, heading, and altitude.
Came off in my hand
at preset intervals. That's what they all say. Traveled routes can be viewed directly in Google Earth.
Absolutely. What are you talking about?
Includes... you just keep eating your microphone. Includes GPX photo stamping feature for adding your favourite photos to your own maps. Looks like a little USB thumb.
Oh, yeah.
$179 from davesgadgetworld.com. The Trackstick 2 personal...
Where do you find these?
Oh, look, don't you worry about that. Trackstick 2 personal GPS tracker.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
Something a bit different this week. www.freerice.com.
Oh, yes, the world needs free rice. Do tell.
It does. Free Rice has two goals. One, to provide English vocabulary to everyone for free.
What?
Two, to help end world hunger by providing rice to hungry people for free.
Yes.
Freerice.com is a word puzzle website.
Oh, okay.
And you...
I was wondering where you're going with this.
You go through the word puzzles, and when you get one of the word puzzles correct, it says, congratulations, you have just donated 20 grains of rice. This is made possible by the sponsors who advertise on the site. So whether you're the CEO of a large corporation or a street child in a poor country, improving your vocabulary can improve your life.
So you go to this website, you play a game, and you're feeding people in...
Correct.
Not quite... Oh, that's a good idea.
And the sponsors are actually donating rice to third world countries.
Fantastic. Mm. So where's the address again? Where do we go to play a game? I'm going to do this after the show.
www.freerice.com.
There is a fine line between genius and madness. Showtime.
Missed it by that much. I know nothing. Nothing.
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
Now, this was a stop press this week. I had the Odd Spot all ready to go, and then a correction came in. The correction says, NASA has refuted claims that it has revised its asteroid predictions based on a correction made to them by a 13-year-old German student. Did you hear about this?
Oh, my goodness, no.
The original Odd Spot was a 13-year-old German schoolboy corrected NASA's estimates on the chances of an asteroid colliding with Earth.
Oh, yeah.
A German newspaper allegedly reported after spotting that the boffins had miscalculated.
Because that's what 13-year-old kids do. They just double-check NASA's calculations in their spare time.
Exactly. Now, what the original report said was that NASA had previously estimated the chances at only 1 in 45,000 that the asteroid was going to collide with Earth, but told its sister organisation, the European Space Agency, that the young whiz kid had got it right and that the risk was more like...
A lot
lower.
To the power of.
That's right.
Oh, yes.
Now, 1 in 450 chance.
Oh, okay.
NASA says there is no chance of this happening, and their estimates remain 1 in 45,000, uninfluenced by the student's claims. And NASA said in a statement, the asteroid will not pass near the main belt of geosynchronous satellites in 2029. The chance of a collision with a satellite is exceedingly remote. There you are.
Fantastic. It's good on the 13-year-old kids out there.
Keep doing
reading,
a good job.
Keep eating your Wheaties and having a good read of the...
studying the geostationary stationary satellites and...
Fantastic.
You go a long way.
Dr. Ron, we're running over. It's been a pleasure this evening.
How's
sharing a fairly spacious... Yeah, good thing. fairly spacious panel, even though the microphone is now still firmly intact back on the microphone stand.
This is where we need to be video streaming.
It does, isn't it? Yes. Sorry, Darren. Next time.
Next time, Darren.
All right. Until next week, the station you're listening to, thanks to everyone for taking us. Send us your info, feedback@techtalkradio.com.au. We love getting your emails. Read them out on air and all that sort of stuff. So until next week, bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panelists Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC. The crew wish to thank all the stations that take the show, including 3WBC and 3XX in Melbourne, Cairns FM, Switch 1197 in Brisbane, 95.3 Huon FM in Tasmania, Queer FM in WA, and Stop and Go Radio in the United States. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.